Good morning. This is March 5th. It's just time's flying. This is the Subcommittee on Education of the Full Ways and Means, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5016 and House Bill 5017. And we have the honor this morning of Rob Saxton, the Deputy Superintendent for Public Instruction, and Megan Irwin from the Early Learning. So we look forward to your feisty song and dance, and let's hit it.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Kaufman Monroe, members of the committee, Rob Saxton, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. I wanted to start today, as I hope I will most days, answering questions that you asked from the previous day. And so the question yesterday was, do you have any org charts, since we seem to like really be interested in the org charts around education, and for good reason. And so we provided several past org charts, and I thought I might just take you through them really quickly and then point out a couple things that continue to be slightly problematic. So to start off with, if you were to look at the first org chart that we have in the packet that we handed out for you, you'll see it's an organization review from 2007-2009, and it was when Susan Castillo was State Superintendent for Public Instruction. And as you look at these org charts, what you really see is that where they've changed is at the top, not in the body of the organizational chart. So you see State Superintendent for Public Instruction, and then State Board of Education, and Deputy Superintendent, and then the rest of the department below that. If you go to the next page, you'll see department.
Can I ask a question right there, Superintendent?
Certainly.
Okay. The area that I've been kind of paying attention to is the Assessment Information Services. And I noticed on your chart yesterday that I know Brian Reeder's the best in the nation, but he was in a spot all by himself. And where would I find where Brian, which column did he fit under in that previous chart? Do you know?
Okay, thank you. If you, Co-Chair Kopp, if you would look under where, if you went directly below Deputy Superintendent, to the very bottom where it says analysis and reporting.
Okay.
Very bottom one in the center. That was Brian Reeder.
Okay, so to follow up brief, just, and I'm not going to focus on this because I know we want to move along. Brian does an incredible amount of work, and has he always been kind of a one-man team, or does he have some support?
Co-Chair,
I'm advocating for Mr. Reeder.
He always has been a very, very small shop, one or two people typically, and right now we have three FTE. He actually has one more FTE than he historically has had in his department. We are authorized to have four in that department, and we have three.
Okay, thank you. And I appreciate it.
If I could, just for a moment, I'd like to push through a couple more here, because I know that there are others that also have some questions about the organizational charts. So on the 2012 org chart, you see that the difference is that the superintendent becomes Superintendent of Public Instruction, there's a Deputy Superintendent, and an Oregon Education Investment Board. On this chart, you'll see the Youth Development Division and the Early Learning Division are directly below the Oregon Education Investment Board, and appear to be reporting directly to that body. And then if you go to the next slide, or the next one, which is Oregon Department of Education Organizational Overview 2014, you see something that nothing really has changed, but the organization chart has changed to some degree, in that you'll see the Early Learning Division reporting directly to the Governor's Office, and the Youth Development Division reporting directly to the Governor's Office. And then the rest of the organization chart is fairly similar, and that is a departure from the previous slide. What I would tell you is that that is an area that seems challenging, is the Early Learning Division exists within the Oregon Department of Education, as I explained yesterday. And the Youth Development Division also exists within the Oregon Department of Education, which means that ultimately, for example, for the budget of ELD or YDD, the head of the agency is responsible, which is me. And yet, the people who oversee those divisions do not report to me. They report to somebody else in every organization chart. They either report to the governor or they report to the person who's in charge of OEIB, the chief education officer. So it's sort of an odd dynamic. And then both of those commissions are appointed by the governor, the early learning board and the youth development commission. So there is a place there that creates some awkward lines of authority that probably at some point in time needs to be cleaned up.
Yes, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Kump. So can you please just tell us how do you think this should be changed for room? You know, if there's room for improvement, what would make more sense in your estimation?
This is the quiz from the end of yesterday's presentation.
Yes, Co-Chairs Kump and Rowe, Representative Taylor. This is the part where I probably, you know, start to look nervous and wiggle around a little bit. As it currently exists, I'll answer your question. I'll tell you from my perspective, I don't know that it's correct, is that the way that we act at this point in time is that the head of the Early Learning Division, Youth Development Division, report to me.
Uh-huh.
But they have a separate and special place within the department. So we have, for example, what we call a service level agreement with those two parts of the department where the office functions that we support them with. We have a very well-defined service level agreement about how we're going to engage with them around technology or budget support or HR and so forth, because we do want to be smart about the way we organize this and make sure that we don't need a whole bunch of different parts of government where we have lots of different back office function. We want one.
Yeah.
It's just a smart way to do that. And yet we also want them to have some separateness because the work that they have to do needs to be coordinated, but also has a very special set of interest groups and components of work that need to get done.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we've tried to do is retain that separateness to some degree with these service level agreements. And then just for purpose of practicality, we've had them report to to me, although officially that probably is not the case.
Follow-up?
Yes, please.
So you said the governor appoints the Early Learning Division Director and the Youth Development Division Director. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and then follow-up, please?
Yes.
And then all the entire board, or does then the board select the director?
Co-Chairs Compton, Representative Taylor. Also, the governor appoints the boards.
And how many people serve on the ELD board and the YDD board, please? Approximately.
Co-Chairs Compton, Monroe, I'm not sure I can answer that question. I think it's 21 on the Youth Development Division, and on the Early Learning Council, 19 spots, mm-hmm. 18 people currently.
Okay.
Thank you, Megan.
And so I have one last question, I promise. And so for the early literacy that you were talking about yesterday, the $85 million, which is, you know, sounds like you're very passionate and think that that's a good use of funds, would those funds be managed through the Early Learning Division, or where would they be managed?
Co-Chairs Kump and Rowe, Representative Taylor, those funds would be managed through the Department of Education. Just as any funds that move through the Youth Development Division or Early Learning Division do, they're all managed by the department. It is that some of those funds are certainly earmarked for specific pieces of work.
Okay.
And so within the $85 million that I'm talking about, some of those pieces of work would be earmarked specifically for the early learning component and some for the K-12 component and some in support of both,
okay.
Which is part of why we need to figure out how to really combine those and make sure that we have a smooth P through 20, this would be obviously birth really to age 8 system.
Okay, and you feel you have a plan for that to work? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, and I promise we're not going to nitpick on the org charts all day, but thank you for bringing them because it is very interesting.
I can't make
that
promise.
Yeah, I can't speak for my chair. So it is interesting to watch the development. And so I have two questions about that. One is there still an executive officer to the state board? Because that position seems to have fallen off the chart.
Co-chairs Compton Rowe, Representative Smith Warner, yes, there still is a person who acts as support for the State Board of Education.
Okay.
It is in the Deputy Superintendent's office and serves basically
as. It's on the 12 chart, but then it just.
Yes, serves basically as Board Secretary.
Okay, great.
Secretary of the Board.
And then my other question, if I may, is government legal affairs, public affairs, do they no longer exist?
Co-chairs Compton Rowe, Representative Smith Warner, also in the Deputy Superintendent's office, and it is the Government Legal Affairs Division, also known as GLAM. Just so you know.
That's a great acronym. Okay. It would make me want to work there.
Governor and Legal Affairs Manager. That happens to be Cindy Hunt, who's got the red face back there.
No wonder it's GLAM.
Absolutely.
New nickname.
It is glamorous. Okay. So where do those fall under the current? And please, no, I'm not doing this as a gotcha.
No,
I'm just trying to understand where everybody continues to, reside.
Well, they are in the Office of Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, and if we blew up our org chart completely, which we do have, by the way, chart that shows the whole deal, and all of that is in there under the Deputy Superintendent's office.
Because sometimes having it still as a separate box indicates, and not having it, sometimes it indicates something, sometimes it doesn't. So I just wondered if there was any particular. Thank you.
And the only last thing that I have, Deputy Superintendent, is the audit committee that used to be under the state board fell off the chart, too. Where are they located?
Yes, Co-Chair Comp, also in the Deputy Superintendent's office, and we do have an internal auditor.
And that's one person?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Big job.
Yes.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for point of clarification, since it came up, I think I misunderstood yesterday, and so I wanted to get on the record my misunderstanding. We were talking about taking $85 million for a third grade reading initiative out of $60 million, and I was under the impression at the end of that discussion that that's what we were trying to do. But then I talked to Chair Comp yesterday, and I want to clarify that $85 million does not come out of the $60 million that the co-chairs have tentatively given us to work with for early learning initiatives and other things we're working on. Is that correct? They're
Thank
two separate.
You for your clarification.
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, the co-chairs in their framework put aside $60 million basically for new initiatives, of which the literacy is part of. As well as any of the early learning investments that you'll hear about later today or tomorrow or Monday or a number of things.
Co-chairs, I was so hoping I was wrong. Mm-hmm. I misunderstood that.
As I explained, the sort of two different routes, the governor's budget is heavier into specific investments. The co-chairs framework has a little over 300 more in the state school fund as going out to districts directly. So
follow up then?
Absolutely.
As an aside, is the $85 million in addition to the 7.235, or did the co-chairs include the 85 in the 7.235?
The Madam Chair,
yes,
Representative Huffman, the 7.235 figure is the state school fund. So that's the money that goes directly to school districts. The 85 is a separate program or a grant and aid that at this stage in the framework would have to be financed out of that $60 million pot of funds that they set aside or in other reductions across the education area, including, you know, potentially in the department. But keep in mind there's there's matching requirements, there's maintenance of effort. We all have to watch that too for all the federal funds that flow through the agency.
So as I go digging through the budget, just exercise caution, is that what you're
always exercise caution.
Co-Chair Monroe, did you have a comment?
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, yeah, getting the 85 out of the 60 kind of reminds me of feeding the 5,000.
We're going to need a blessing.
There's some biblical, reflections here. Okay, is that it? Thank you, Rob. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you, Co-Chairs.
Okay, I see we're on 63.
Yes. Office of Learning, Education, Equity. We can move along here, I hope. This is a new department starting in 2013 in the Department of Education, this Office of Education Equity. Prior to 2013, we had about 2.5 FTE working on issues of equity in the department, and yet we had really significant achievement gaps for students of color specifically across the state. And we added to that with new work intended to close achievement gaps and improve the quality of programs and best practices within districts. They support the federal program for migrant education, civil rights, and English language learners. The state also supports these programs, and in 2013 added Closing the Achievement Gaps grant work. We also began to offer technical support to districts and schools in an effort to improve their delivery to students. We originally had the Indian Education Specialist position in the Office of Equity, but given the special nature of the relationship between the state government and the 9 sovereign tribal governments in Oregon, we decided it was best to move that component of the work into the Office of the Deputy Superintendent, simply because of the government status of the 9 tribes. I'm pleased with the work of the Equity Division has underway and regular to hear from school districts regarding the supportive partnerships that they're creating. Just a couple of things that they have underway that I think are interesting. One is a biliteracy seal, so that any student in the state of Oregon who graduates and can demonstrate biliteracy, that they would get a special seal on their diploma that would have meaning to any college that they apply to, basically saying that they are a native or near native speaker in 2 languages. And that work is underway, and that seal will be delivered for the very first time this spring. They've been working specifically around dual language startups. One of the initiatives that we had was to implement some dual language programs across the state as a methodology that's highly effective around helping students be successful in their downstream learning, especially from grade 6 through grade 12. We see incredible long-term results out of dual language programs. They have been involved in recruiting teachers from multiple places to deliver on some of the language work that we're attempting to do, including teachers from China, Spain, and Mexico. We have some initiation of some Mandarin Chinese language programs in the state, some dual language programs. And part of the recruitment from teachers from China is around that, and there are some districts in the state that have those programs underway, specifically Sisters, Portland Public. And there's one other that I have forgotten at this point in time. I know that there's been some interest in looking at the model that the state of Utah has put in place. And Utah passed something called Senate Bill 41 in 2008. And they had a goal of having 115 programs. They now have 116. But this is by 2015 was their goal. And to have 30,000 students enrolled in these dual language programs. They have 25,000 students now that are enrolled in these dual language programs in the state of Utah. And basically what they did in order to get this done is they offered districts money, and I'll get the exact amount for you. Don't have it today, but I'll get the exact amount. They offered districts money to offer up these dual language programs, and then they continued to give them the additional resource for 6 years as they ramped up the program. And part of that is that typically dual language programs start and grow. So you start with your kindergarten class, and then you need first and second grade, and first and second, or first and kindergarten and first, then kindergarten first and second, all the way up to 6th grade typically. And then really robust programs then continue with that work through 6th grade. But that was part of the reason that they wanted to have the resource last for 6 years, is because there is a cost with adding each additional grade as it moves through the progression.
Just a second, Rob. Mr. Yes. Wilson? Oh, I thought you wanted to...
Contemplate.
Yes, Mr. Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For those of us that have been around the building more than 3 days, we know David Porter, and his interest in Mandarin language initiatives, more in the schools, more transferring students back and forth, and... And so I was talking to Rob the other day pursuing this, asking, are we putting more of an emphasis on Mandarin language opportunities than we have in the past? And I would like you to answer that question. And the other thing was, we were talking on the Utah thing. I said, well, why would Utah be so much further ahead? And we were just kind of brainstorming, maybe because it's the base of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and their missions, that maybe that is more of a state initiative because of the church needs. So as a possibility, but it sounds like they're really doing some pretty cool things with Mandarin language.
Co-chairs Coppin and Representative Huffman, yes, we are focusing a little bit more on Mandarin language than we used to in the state, but I would argue that probably is mostly around decisions that local districts have made and not decisions that we've made at the state level. And there are some additional Mandarin language programs, but compared to what they're doing in Utah, it's almost nothing. They dedicated about $2 million a year. It was an initiative of the governor at that point in time, and one of the state senators there, and I've spoken with that state senator on a couple different occasions, and we have some phone calls into him so that we can get more specifics about what they did and bring those forward to you as quickly as possible. But
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Co-Chair Monroe.
Yeah, I mentioned this in the past. My grandson is in the Mandarin program at Woodstock Elementary in Southeast Portland, and he has been studying Mandarin language since he was 3 years old. He's now 10 in fifth grade. So what is that, 8 years or so? And he's relatively fluent in Mandarin. In fact, I'm hoping to be able to travel to China in the next couple of years and take him along as a translator. He's very good. Eric, who's a staff to some of our Ways and Means subcommittees, teaches English in China, and so he's pretty fluent in Mandarin. So when my grandson comes to visit me during spring break, he likes to chat with Eric.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Representative Smith Warner, and we're not going to go down the yellow brick road far.
I just wanted to say I would feel remiss not to mention that in my district there is a Vietnamese immersion program at Roseway Heights, which is only, I believe, the fifth Vietnamese immersion in the country. And so that's another area, particularly in East Portland, Multnomah County, that population. It's a growing population, and this is a great way to engage them. And it's been, it has its challenges, but it's really exciting.
Right. Thank you. So there are 13 FTE in the Office of Education Equity, and it's just been a department that's done really incredible work, and I see them moving the English language learner plan across the state in a different way than we've ever been able to. And I'm always sort of amazed at the number of times that districts get back to me and say, we had your equity team come out and work with us on some things. And the way that we're thinking about this and engaging in this is really different than we've ever thought about before. Thanks for their help. So it's nice to have that. 64 and 65, I'm moving on to the Office of Learning Student Services, which really are more commonly known as special education. And this division is responsible for over $1 billion in programs and passes through approximately 93% of those funds onto local providers. Many of those are federal funds. The primary work is the delivery of monitoring of special education grants and programs to districts. And when we do our monitoring, as I said before, we always make a point of ensuring that districts are meeting federal requirements, but also that we're offering support for best practice and help to improve programs. This division also works with the early intervention and early childhood special education, long-term care and treatment, hospital programs, the Oregon School for the Deaf, and youth corrections. There are 71 FTE, about 70 FTE in this department. The Office of Research and Data Analysis is the one that Representative Comp could not find. It involves Brian Reeder, and Brian really does do great work, and so does the other folks in his department. And this is one of our smallest divisions. Brian's an economist by trade, and he leads really high-quality, accurate, trusted, and highly credible work. Once in a while, when I try to get him to make something look more like I'd like it to be, he just flat says, no, this is what the numbers show, and this is what we're going to have out there. And I appreciate that very much about the way he does the work. The office...
So many of us know, too. So.
Yes, yes. The office does data analysis for policymakers, legislators, the state board, the governor, Oregon Education Investment Board, the department, and me specifically. And he shares the research with the Oregon Education Investment Board and also helps others leverage the work and data he uses, including some of our partners like Echo Northwest, Chalkboard, and Northwest Regional Education Lab, which helps magnify some of the data that we are able to collect and use, and we have very specific, careful agreements with any data that we share around personally identifiable information. The Office of the Deputy Superintendent. The Office of Deputy Superintendent provides leadership, works with and staffs the State Board of Education, writes and recommends Oregon Administrative Rule, acts as a liaison with the legislature and governor's office, oversees operations of the department, which include the human resources and Indian education positions. There are 11 FTE and a budget of $4.2 million in that department.
Yes, Representative Smith Mortner.
Is that counting GLAM in that?
Co-chair comp, Representative Smith Mortner, yes, it is.
Thank you.
Yes, all parts of that. So all HR, all of our legislative work, managing the state board and doing that work. We have communications FTE there, my deputy chief of staff, and then myself.
That's all within the 11.
All within the 11.
Thank you.
The Indian education position of the Deputy Superintendent's office works with the 9 federally recognized tribes on education matters through the government-to-government process. So each tribe has its own separate government, and there's a relationship with the government of the state of Oregon. And this position also provides support to districts to improve outcomes for Native American students and children in early learning. The current outcomes for our Native American students are arguably among or even are the poorest for all demographic groups. We helped with a study last year that was conducted in partnership between the majority of tribes who led the work, Chalkboard and Echo Northwest, and it provided insight into attendance of Native American students and identified attendance as one of the significant contributing factors regarding the low levels of achievement among our Native American students. And so when I say attendance, I mean lack thereof. Our Indian education specialist is doing a wonderful job, but there is actually so much work for her to do and complete, and we are seeking an additional 1.0 Indian education specialist this session in order to advance that work. We're also...
Just a second. Representative Huffman, and then I have a follow-up also.
Okay, this is just a quick shout-out. I am so proud of Warm Springs for the new K-8 school. The tribal members voted to pay for half the school, and I'm just... They're on a good track, and I'm proud of that. Instead of just coming and asking the state to do everything, they really stepped up, and I'm just wanted to give them credit for that.
Thank you. And wasn't this biennium our first biennium that we put an allocation of just a 0.5 in there?
Co-chair comp, yes, that's true.
And so this request is for a full FTE in addition.
It's for one additional FTE, yes, ma'am. I would say also, Representative Huffman, that is a beautiful school if anybody's had an opportunity to be there. And really the work that the tribes are doing around education right now is remarkable. And I'm so hopeful about what I think we're going to begin to see with the different partnerships that we have between the tribes, their local school districts, and the Department of Education. And a lot of that is because we've got this position and because there's so much interest and care on the part of the tribes for the children who are tribal members and the kind of results that we're currently seeing. And so the work around the mascot issue, bringing people together, some work around development of historically accurate curricula that we have put together and now is housed on websites and so forth at the department that are being shared in partnership with local school districts as out of one of the initiatives out of the last session. And then we're also seeking this session work to improve student attendance. It's $1.5 million, approximately $150,000 would go to each tribe, and they would be working in partnership with their local district, and they would copy the work of Attendance Works, which is a program that's evidence-based around improving attendance in multiple districts across the nation. And it's a piece of work that the tribes are very interested in. And if we could continue to make gains there, I think we'll just really start to see different outcomes. And it's just fabulous to have the partnership that we have going on there. And I there's too many people to thank, but April, who is our Indian education specialist, has been fabulous.
Representative Springer and then Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. You started to go there, Rob, so I want to kind of dig in just a little bit more. We did have the 0.5 up until this last session, last biennium, and now it's one FTE instead of a shared 0.5, which was not a fair ask. It absolutely wasn't, and ineffective in my opinion. And I've met April, and she's doing some great work, and as most of us know, I've done a lot of work on the mascot issue and issues related to that. So I hope that I support the additional FTE in this, because my hope and desire is that between the two, we can at least begin. We're talking two people in 197 districts. But that we can at least begin to work with those districts that are not as diverse, and those districts that maybe, in addition to that, maybe some districts that have a local tribe and they didn't know until 3 years ago what that local tribe was. So I hope it's not just a focus on our Native American students, which is extraordinarily important, but also that we take a bigger look at that and the diversity issue of that is this golden opportunity right at our hands in some of our districts.
Co-Chair Scott Monroe, Representative Springer, thank you for that. And there's the complexity of this, as you know, having given so much of your time around the mascot issue, is a really interesting one, and one that's been a huge piece of learning for me. Because not only do we have the tribes, but then we also have many Native Americans who live in Oregon that are not Oregon tribal members. The exact number of that is often discussed, but I'm going to say in the 63,000 range for students in the state, depending on how you decide you want to count, right? But there are lots of Native American students in the state, and the outcomes that we have are poor. One of the things that April's been able to do, our Indian education specialist, over the past year, is work collectively with the tribes to design a new Oregon Indian education plan. And I know I drove you crazy with plans earlier, and so I won't go into that, but in order to really deliver on that plan, it's going to take more than what we currently have.
Rep. Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Comp. Will the tribes be working with the hubs? Will they have access to the services that the hubs are going to be offering?
Co-Chairs Comp and Rural Representative Taylor, yes, absolutely. Okay. And I know that Megan could add to that when she has the opportunity. Okay. Thank you.
When we get that far.
We're getting really close.
Okay.
Our Office of Information Technology provides internal support for all the department's technology needs. They also create education-specific applications, many of which offer support to districts and schools in regard to data collection and reporting. They also collect over 100 different reports for the U.S. Department of Education and or for our report card information that we put out publicly. It's a thing that we've worked hard to try to reduce over time, and we're getting close to the minimum number that I think we can get to. There are 47.29 FTE in this department, and they have a budget of $15.3 million. Data systems. As you'll hear in the early learning presentation, one of the expectations of the 2012 Race to the Top grant, which was a federal grant that we got in early childhood, was to create a five-point QRIS, quality rating and improvement system, for daycare providers in the state of Oregon. It also required that we collect the data through an early learning information system, which the grant provided for. It's a web-based tool that allows the early learning division to manage the data associated with the quality rating and improvement system. ODE received a $10.4 million grant.
Mr. Saxon, you did not state the most important thing on that page. That was fully implemented by December 31st. Thank you. Congratulations. Now we can move on.
All right. Thank you. ODE received a $10.4 million grant under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which I couldn't spit out yesterday, to create a data system which is not to create a data system which is complete and forms the foundation for our Oregon Education Investment Board's longitudinal data system, sometimes referred to as the state longitudinal data system. We had partners from the Oregon University System, Employment Department, College and Career Workforce Development, TSPC, and Early Childhood. The work did four things. It consolidated and expanded access to early childhood data, allowed data exchange with higher ed and workforce, expanded a student-teacher link in K-12 data systems, and created a statewide data quality plan. The OEIB is seeking $10.2 million in general obligation bonds to complete the work so the data are available to policymakers. So sometimes when I talk about this grant, this Project Alder grant, this is a really big piece and neat piece of work that was done by people at the department. So I just described it in really technical terms, so I'll try to explain it in really simple terms. What we've attempted to do here is not move identifiable information through from early childhood to K-12 to higher ed to workforce, but instead create a mechanism where these data get dumped together into a tub, basically, and then get scrubbed so we know what kinds of experiences and learning opportunities students had in any one of these systems and what the long-term outcome for those students are without identifying who they are. Because each one of these groups collects different kinds of identifiable information. We don't want to know who the individual is, but we want to know what experiences they had and what the outcome looked like, so that we can replicate experiences that change outcomes. So that's the idea of what this does, and what Alder did was build basically that tub to put this stuff in so that that could happen. It's an interesting process. The other point I want to make is that we used $10 million in federal funds to create the basis of this, and now we're seeking another $10 million so that it can be finalized and we can actually get something out of that. And so that's what the general obligation bond that OEIB is seeking would do for the state longitudinal data system, and it would build off of something we've already created.
So, Mr. Saxon, this is a one-time request for this additional bond?
Co-Chair Comp, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
The Office of Finance and Administration, which is our business office, and does all of the Oregon Department of Education's accounting, budgeting, procurement, and contracting, and there's lots of each one of those things. And we really like to commend the department. They did incredible work out of last session. So last session, as soon as we were done, we put together a plan to get all the grants and contracts out from the strategic initiatives, as well as manage the other things that we had done. And we also took into the department two new divisions, early learning and youth development. And so the work that needed to be done to cause all that to happen on part of this department with contracts and so on was pretty impressive. We grew by about 130 FTE because of the youth development division and the early learning division and some FTE around the strategic initiatives. And they were able to do all this work with only two additional new FTE, and so it's been an incredible piece of work that they've been able to do. They're responsible for the state school fund and its distribution. They're also in charge of the biggest components, a couple other big components at the department, fingerprinting and background checks for anyone who needs to be fingerprinted or background checked in education across the state. And they also do all the pupil transportation, which is a big piece of work. 54.6 FTE in that area, and they administer about $6.9 billion. Like I said, plenty to do there. And with that, I will turn this over to my more able colleague, Megan Irwin, in the Early Learning Division, Acting Systems Director. Megan.
And Mr. Saxon, I have a question for some research for you can follow up with us next week. There was legislation passed several years ago that there's funding that is set aside, or I don't know, I'd have to ask Doug about how this is, to have school buses retrofitted. And I'm curious if school districts have taken advantage of that statute that they can get their buses retrofitted from diesel to, because I don't like all that diesel around our children, and I just don't know if we have any statistics or if it was ever used. So
thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I don't know either, but we'll find out and
okay.
Bring that response tomorrow.
Senator Roblin might know the answer.
I do know of one school district in the south Eastern Oregon. I believe it was Mammoth Falls that actually converted the bus fleet to compressed natural gas and found a great savings. So when you go look at it, I think you will find that there are a few that have done it. I don't know if they took care of the grant, but I would assume they did.
Well, yeah, and it's just one of those things that we pass and then we don't follow up on it or put any more communication out there about these things being available.
Thank you.
Megan,
good
welcome.
Morning. Thank you. Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. For the record, my name is Megan Irwin, and I'm the Acting Early Learning System Director for the Early Learning Division. And I'm really excited to be here today to talk to you about the work that the Early Learning Division does inside of the department. Over the course of my time with you, I'm going to provide you just a little bit of background on the division and an overview of what we've been charged to do by statute and an overview of our budget. I'll share a little bit with you around the Early Learning Council's strategic plan so that you can kind of understand the policy framework that our work is grounded in. And then I'll walk you through the key programs and initiatives that the Early Learning Division runs. I did just want to take 1 second to respond to Representative Taylor's question regarding the hubs and the tribes, if that would be okay.
Mm-hmm.
So as part of the request for applications and through the hub process, any applicant had to tell us how they were partnering or planning to partner with their local tribe. And then over the course of the last 11 months as the hubs have been rolling out, it looks a little different in each place. In some communities, it's very formal. So, for example, the Burns Paiute tribe, the Cow Creek tribe, and the Warm Springs tribe have formal memorandums of understanding with their local hub, and there's some cross-governance going on. Other tribes, it's a little bit more informal because to get that MOU in place, it goes through tribal government, and there's just a lot of steps in that process.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been really working to hold every hub responsible for working with the tribes in their area, in addition to the urban Indian population. So, for example, in Early Learning Multnomah, they're partnered with NEA mm-hmm. to really figure out how to reach the youth that Rob was talking about who are Native American but maybe not enrolled in an Oregon tribe. So thanks for letting me answer that question today. Okay, so back to the formal presentation. Just to get you started with what the division is responsible for, we were created in 2013 with a mandate to ensure that all children arrive at school prepared for kindergarten. And to that end, we're responsible for creating a cohesive early learning system and then for administration of the programs that make up that system and for regulating and improving the quality of childcare in Oregon. And our work is governed and overseen by the Early Learning Council, which is made up of community leaders from across the state who are all appointed by the governor. And the Early Learning Council is directed to oversee a unified system of early childhood services, including funding and administration. And they're also the body that promulgates all rules related to early learning programs. They're charged with aligning services with child-centered outcomes, aligning work between healthcare and early childhood education and K-12 and early childhood education. And they're responsible for really directing our focus on children who are at risk of arriving at school unprepared for kindergarten. And there is actually a statutory definition of at risk for arriving at school unprepared for kindergarten. And then the other point here, which Rob already made today, is that the position I'm currently filling, the Early Learning Systems Director, is appointed by the governor. You've seen my next two slides before, so I promise I won't belabor them for you. But I just can't emphasize enough the work that's happened over the last 2 years to build a cohesive system for early learning in our state for the first time. You've seen this before. The old system was complicated, and it wasn't just complicated for people who work in Salem. It is also complicated and unfriendly for families. And it makes it hard for communities to work with each other and to work with families and to work with this constellation of state agencies. In addition, each part of this previous system had different goals despite serving the same clients. And I've said this before and I'll say it again, when we only focus on programs in the absence of creating a system, we only serve the people who find their way to us and who we have a slot for. And for me, that is why the structural reforms that we undertook matter so much. I don't think that families care which agency administers the services that they need. They just want to be able to find what they need when they need it. So as we've talked about before, things today are more streamlined. And again, our goal is not to make a simpler org chart. although we can talk about org charts if we want to, I'm happy to do that. We really want to create, and we're in the process still of working to create a system that's more coherent so that it actually works for kids and families and we get the outcomes we want. I put this slide in because it is really easy to get lost in systems talk. And to ground myself, I think a lot about the babies who are just born or who are going to be born this year. And 8 years from now, when they're in third grade, will they have gotten the supports that they need from adults in the first 8 years of their lives so that they're able to read on grade level by the time that they leave third grade? And will they be healthy, and will they have been raised in families where there are quality interactions happening in those first 8 years of lives as their brains are building themselves? And I think that we are building a system that can get them there if we can shift our thinking a few degrees to really think about investing early in prevention and early supports, and then really working to invest in the things it's going to take to build that system. And the people represented on the numbers here on this slide are really the reason why that's so important. We have 230,000 children in our state under the age of five. Half of them are born on Medicaid. That means half of them are born living at 200% of the federal poverty level or less. And about a quarter of them are exposed to a pretty well-recognized set of risk factors that, again, put them at risk for arriving at school unprepared. And so I think that there are just real challenges that families and young children are up against in our state.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, Megan, what are some of those more prevalent risk factors?
Sure. So poverty is one, living in unstable housing, living with a parent who's struggling with drug or alcohol addiction, neglect, abuse. Those are the big ones that really are impacting kids in our state. Sometimes you also might hear them called adverse childhood experiences.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Follow-up?
Rep. Spurrier.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Follow-up on the Senator's question. What defines unstable housing?
There's an official definition that I can
give
you.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm just trying to figure out roughly what that means.
There's an official definition, but these are kids who are homeless or moving from house to house, living not necessarily homeless, living on the street, but maybe living in a hotel or couch surfing with their parents.
No address.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's my layman's definition of an official term.
That works for me.
So I bring all of this up because when we talk about our budget, both the division's current budget and their requested budget, I just think it's really important for us to remember what the science regarding early brain development tells us, which is that the architecture of a person's brain depends a lot on the quality of the interactions that they have with adults early in their life. And that once that sensitive period of development ends, it's really hard to alter brain circuits. And that's why we wind up investing so much in remedial programs, which are expensive and get us somewhat marginal returns down the road. And so the quality of a young person's early environment and the availability of appropriate experiences really determines how successful they're going to be later as a learner and also as a person. And again, this only highlights the need for us to invest both in interventions that are helping children right now and invest in building a system that's going to allow those interventions to reach more children and be more effective. Additionally,
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, back on the providers on the previous slide down at the bottom there, how many of those are certified my understanding is today they don't have to be certified to provide child care, but some are and some aren't.
Co-Chair Monroe, that's a great question. These 4,500 child care providers represented here are all licensed. So that represents the number of licensed, certified child care providers in our state. And then there's a larger number of unlicensed child care providers or unregulated child care providers. And we're going to talk a lot about that as my presentation continues.
Okay, because, I need to know how many of our young children are in licensed or approved facilities and how many are just babysat.
Exactly.
And a follow-up, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was a recent visit to a couple of child care centers with Megan that a related tie-in, which is another budget we're going to be looking at, community colleges. And this week in the Dallas Chronicle, they had an article where Dr. Frank Toda continues to have to lay people off because of revenue and budget problems. And I didn't realize until the trip with Megan how critical Columbia Gorge Community College is to the child care providers in the Gorge in providing the certification classes for them. It's right there, it's local, it's handy. And so I'd hate for them to not be able to have the budget, and that be one of the programs they have to cut because of budget. Yep.
Please proceed, Megan.
Great. This is the last kind of framing slide, but I think it's pretty important. So as we're thinking about where to invest in the next budget, we need to think about who the children under five in our state are and recognize that the demographics are changing. So one in three children in Oregon under five is not white. And as you can see from this chart, these changes are happening across the state in both urban and rural communities. And one thing that really stands out to me is I've been looking at and thinking about this demographic data, which comes from the American Community Survey from the US Census, is that we now actually have five counties in our state where the majority of children under five are not white. And so in an area that is so important with demographics shifting so dramatically, I think that these changing demographics really underscore the importance of investing in communities and really partnering with communities to understand the needs of a really pretty rapidly changing demographic of children and families, which makes the investment that we've made in the early learning hubs, I think, all the more important. Questions? So with that framing, we'll now move on to the pie chart section of my presentation, where we'll take a look at our budget. So the Early Learning Division's budget is $337 million, and close to half of those resources come from the federal government. The better portion of that is from the Child Care Development Fund, which supports our child care system, our licensing system, basically, and child care subsidies. The CCDF funding comes to the Early Learning Division through the federal government. The legislature decides how to spend it in line with federal rules, of course, and then it's jointly administered by the Department of Human Services and the Early Learning Division. And as you'll see in a moment, the bulk of our state general funds, about $128 million this biennium, go to the Oregon pre-kindergarten program, which is state-funded Head Start. Most of the money
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I skipped ahead for a few slides, and okay. I don't think I saw the answer to my question.
Overachiever.
If I was an overachiever, I'd have the answer. as I look at these slides and the state money, the state budget that is funding programs and opportunities for some students, some of our kids, I'm trying to get a feel for, I guess the percentage maybe of our under five population that is served by state-funded programs and those where mom and dad write a check or mom and dad keep them home or something like that, and the state isn't involved in that. I'm trying to get a feel for how many kids we're really serving with public dollars and how many kids we're serving that aren't served with those public dollars.
Yes, that co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Springer, that's a great question, and we'll work on getting the specific percentages. What I can tell you is that about 15,000 of the 230,000 children under five are served in publicly funded programs like the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program or Early Head Start, which leaves a pretty big number of children who are in child care, whether it's licensed or license exempt, where mom and dad are predominantly footing the bill, unless they're one of the small number of families who are receiving a child care subsidy in which mom and dad are still footing part of the bill. So we have a relatively small number of children who are in state-funded early learning programs like state-funded preschool.
Please.
Follow up. I don't even know my question exactly, but as I look at that 15% and we want to move the dial to kindergarten readiness. And keep in mind, a parent has the right, if they want to keep their their kiddo at home until they're seven. But if they want to keep their kid, well, if they start school, but if they want to keep their kid at home and homeschool, that's their choice. But I just see a gap there. Is it a good gap? Is it not? I don't know. But that to me is kind of shocking that we're investing in 15%. That's not to say we shouldn't. I'm just saying there's 85% more there.
Bunch.
Yes, co-chairs.
I don't know that that's a question.
Well, co-chairs Comp and Monroe, I would just, Representative Springer, I would respond by saying yes, and I think you're keying in on what makes the early learning system so complex. It's every program that we run is voluntary, and yet these early developmental years are so important, and we have a relatively small number of children who are able to access, again, state-funded, publicly-funded early learning programs. That's one reason why our Office of Child Care has begun to focus not just on regulating licensed child care and making sure that they're complying with basic standards, but also really working to focus on making sure that the licensed child care facilities that children are in are places where learning and development is starting to happen on purpose, and then providing child care providers with the professional development and supports that they need to make that happen in their program, again, if they want to. So everything in early childhood is voluntary, and it makes getting kids ready for school complex.
And follow up with Representative Springer and then Senator Roblin.
Sure.
And this is just to be very clear on where I'm coming from. It's not a question or doesn't even need a response unless somebody wants to. I'm not advocating mandating anything. I'm just saying as we look at those numbers, there's a big spread,
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we know the percentage of eligible kids for Head Start and early Head Start that are not being, not getting into the system?
Yes, co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Senator Roblin. I will tell you what I think it is, and I reserve the right to fact check my number, but I think it's about 25% of the eligible kids who we're not serving right now. And to be eligible for Head Start or early Head Start, you're living at 100% of the federal poverty level or less, or you're in foster care.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Just to get that number, to make sure that we're all thinking of the same number. So if the pot of kids who are eligible for Head Start because they are at or below 100% of poverty or a foster child, are you saying that we are serving 75% of them and 25% we're missing? Or is that not?
Oh, excuse me. Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Smith-Warner, we're serving 65% of eligible children right now. So it's actually a little bit more than 25% that we're not serving.
Okay.
Can't do that subtraction in my head.
Okay.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
My wife was a day school director for 20 years, and it's always shocked to me what day school teachers get paid or don't get paid. It's barely above minimum wage in most cases. And yet, you know, we would like to have them trained. We would like to have them skilled. But the pay is so poor that, you know, if I were advising somebody going to local community college, you know, what do you want to do with your life, I wouldn't advise them to train as a preschool teacher because the pay is so poor.
Thank you. Okay, Megan.
Thank you. Okay.
And just kind of do a clock check here. I don't know about the rest of you, but I've been late to my 10 o'clock meetings, so I'd like to finish it about 5 till.
Okay. Co-Chair Comp, just let me know when you want me to
you've got plenty of time, okay. But we've been going right up to the hour, and it's causing, our schedules get kind of twisted around.
Gotcha. Okay, so just to go back to our budget, most of the money that we receive as a division goes right out the door and into Communities to Support Program for Children and Families. We only hold back 8% of our funds at the division to support our operations, and the rest goes out as special payments, which are programs and services that directly impact children and families. That 8% is predominantly our child care licensing system, so licensing staff, background checks, fingerprinting, monitoring, et cetera, which allows us to fulfill our state and our federal regulatory mandates.
This is what those special payments look like. So again, that 92% that goes out to the field. Most of those special payments, close to 83%, go to either CCDF-funded activities like employment-related daycare or to the Oregon pre-kindergarten program. CCDF is 42% of our special payments budget, and OPK is 41%. Both of these programs have a lot of really specific requirements, and so the part of our budget that has any small amount of flexibility is actually quite small. The major initiatives that we've launched to really do that systems transformation or systems connection work come out of those thin slices. So the early learning hubs, for example, are just 1% of our budget, as is the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund, which I talked a little bit about last week, and we'll talk more about when we get to the program section of this presentation. If you look at our current service level for 15-17, the picture is really not very different from this biennium. A significant share of our resources remain to be coming from the federal government.
Yes, Senator Roblin.
Thank you. So like K-12, do you have maintenance of effort requirements with the federal funds to keep serving the same number of special needs children?
Co-chairs,
just a minute, Senator, I couldn't hear you.
Oh,
if, if you want to turn your microphone, yeah. Maybe.
I was saying maintenance of effort funds like K-12 has requirements. Do the same requirements adhere to federal funds at the preschool level?
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Senator Roblin, I believe yes. With with the CCDF fund, we don't run the program that serves special needs children under school age. That's the early intervention, early childhood special education program. They definitely have maintenance of effort requirements. And then there is federally funded Head Start in our state. That funding goes directly from the federal government to the grantees and never passes through the early learning division. Those programs, I believe, have maintenance of effort requirements, but it doesn't touch the work that we're doing.
Okay, thank you.
And so again, if you looked at our 15-17 current service level for special payments, it looks really similar to how it looks this biennium, and that's what this slide shows. This looks at what 15-17 current service level would look like for our special payments. And other than the Oregon pre-kindergarten program and CCDF, we're still, again, operating with lots of thin slices. These slices represent really great programs like the Relief Nursery Program and Healthy Families Oregon, like the Early Learning Hubs, which I'll talk about later.
And Representative Smith Warner.
Sorry, I have one quick question. In the 2013-15 special payments, there is one of those small
and
slices.
Representative Smith Warner,
oh,
I'm going to ask you to do the same thing. Thank you.
In the 2013-15 special payments, slide 84, there's $3 million for family preservation. And that is not, I don't see that in the 2015-17. Can you give me a brief what that is and whether it's somewhere else now or whether it is something gone away?
Yes, absolutely. Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Smith Warner. That is funding that used to go to the Commission on Children and Families and has now, in the 15-17 current service level, been rolled into early learning hubs. So also on the slide from 13-15, you would have seen something called Great Start, also has rolled into early learning hubs. So that's why the early learning hub percentage is actually up to 3% of our budget now, because we have fully implemented across the state, and we've fully integrated former commission dollars into their budgets for the next biennium.
And just one last quick thing.
Oh, please.
And that is not related to the Family Preservation Project that the Department of Corrections runs, that a number of people are currently trying to maintain or preserve.
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Smith Warner. That's right. So the
name coincidence.
It's just a name coincidence. It's a federal funding stream, and they all kind of get called the same thing.
Thank you.
Yeah. This final budget slide just takes a look at our 15-17 projected federal funds. As you can see here, the majority of our federal resources are from the CCDF fund. There's a theme there. Again, most of which we transfer to the Department of Human Services to pay for employment-related daycare. 80% of our federal CCDF funding goes toward ERDC subsidies right now. We've been very fortunate in Oregon to have been the recipient of a Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge grant, which we project to be about 10% of our federal funding for the next biennium. Now, that funding goes through December 2016. We've learned recently that the federal government may allow states to apply for a one-year no-cost extension. This is new information for us, but we may want to be strategic in taking advantage of that because it would give us another year to complete the work, and it would give us the ability to continue to stretch those federal dollars all the way through the whole 15-17 biennium.
And so when we're looking at that early childhood and on the continuum, so how would we, if we did that for 2016, would we be able to impact like 2 years of student potential child investment there, or 3 years, or
Co-Chair Comp, that's a
I
good
can't calculate that fast.
It's a good question. So the Early Learning Challenge Grant has really been focused on helping us build out our early learning system. So it paid, for example, for that early learning information system that Rob mentioned. And it's also what's allowed us to get the quality rating improvement system up and running. So where it's making a direct impact on child care providers and kids, it's really through the work that we've been doing to build the quality rating improvement system, and it would just give us extra time to get that system really up and running if we were able to take advantage of such an extension.
So it's an investment in long-term in program.
Exactly.
Thank
That's
you.
Right. We are really working on looking at, as we think about the future past the end of the Race to the Top grant, looking at how to leverage our existing program investments, as well as looking at how to leverage proposed new general fund investments that we're asking for this year to really carry forward our systems building work, so that as it starts to wind down, we have not only a real system, but one that's sustainable. The total grant was $30 million. I want to be on the record saying, do not worry, we will not be coming and asking for $30 million state general fund dollars to supplant that. We've really been working to spend the federal money to build the systematic connections that we need to, so that we have a cohesive early learning system. Because the work of the Early Learning Council is an important part of everything that we do, I wanted to take just a little bit of time to share our mission and a very high-level look at the Early Learning Council's strategic plan, so that when I go into the last third of my presentation, which is all about our programs, you kind of have a sense of what those programs are grounded in and why we're making the kinds of asks we are making this biennium. So our mission is simple and important. It's to support all of Oregon's young children and families to learn and thrive. And as you'll see throughout, I think any time I'm in front of you, children and families are really at the center and at the heart of everything that we do. And this is just a quick look at the values that at the Early Learning Division we ground ourselves in. This is the way that we seek to behave when we're working with communities and with providers out in the field. The division and the Early Learning Council have been given three high-level goals in statute. These goals are also shared by early learning hubs. And these three goals, children that arrive at kindergarten ready to succeed, families that are healthy, stable, and attached, and an early learning system that's coordinated, aligned, and family-centered, really reinforce one another. And our work, everything that we do, flows back to at least one of these goals, if not all of them. So just in January, the Early Learning Council adopted its strategic plan for 2015 through 2020. Earlier this week, you heard about ODE's strategic plan. All of the work that you see highlighted here, everything that I'm talking about, fits into that strategic plan under goal 1.1. So we work really hard to make sure that everything that we're doing out in this big behemoth of an early learning system is folding back in nicely to the work that is being led by Rob at the Department of Education. And I would be happy, if this committee wants it, to submit a really detailed copy of the ELC strategic plan so you can see every strategy and tactic. It didn't fit on a slide, and I didn't feel like I had time to talk through each component of it. So I just wanted you to see at a really high level where they're focusing. Large areas of focus include building that supply of high-quality early learning environments in childcare, community-based settings, and school-based settings, and then working to make them accessible to families, especially accessible to families who might not naturally just find their way there. They've got a really strong focus on parents, making sure that parents have the information, tools, and supports that they need to support the developmental needs of their children. There's a strong focus on providers, making sure that we're supporting early learning educators to achieve higher levels of education, and that we're making educational environments available to them in a way that actually works for the needs of that really pretty specific workforce. And then the council is very deeply focused on linkages to other sectors. The connection to the early grades of elementary school is incredibly important to us, as is the connection to healthcare and human services, especially in that infant toddler range, age range of life. And then they're focused on supporting the division staff to do the systems building work that we've embarked upon. They have a scorecard that tracks a large number of metrics. Again, they wouldn't all fit on this slide, and I wasn't quite sure the level of depth that this committee would want. So this is just a sampling of some of the metrics that the Early Learning Council is tracking. Additionally, we've developed a set of specific and quantitative measures for the Early Learning Hubs. They have specific targets, and they're closely aligned with the things that the council and the division are tracking. Mm-hmm. Any questions on any of that before I dip my toe into the early learning division structure? Okay. So since the division's relatively new, less than 2 years old, I wanted you to just know how we are structured, since we've had to integrate so many component parts of other state agencies to build the division. So this is just a very, very simple, high-level version of our organizational chart. Where you see a position listed as limited duration, that's a race to the top position. Again, we won't be asking to keep all of those. These are positions that we currently have limitation for, and we'll be requesting that we continue to have limitation for them as we spin down the work in that grant. Going to go through these slides pretty quickly. This one is the director's office, so this is my team. Just like Rob said in his role, I hope that I'm providing leadership and overall sense of vision for the work of the division, also responsible for performance management and working with the Early Learning Council. And then my office, a couple of my direct reports are directly leading our work around equity and community engagement, which I think is critical to have at a leadership level, again, given the changing demographics of Oregon.
And Megan, your three limited duration people out there with your 5 FTE, won't they leave a big hole when they're gone?
Co-chair comp, it's a good question. There, we will be asking to keep some of our race to the top positions, the ones that are most critical to our mission. One of those limited duration positions is our public affairs specialist, mm-hmm. Which is pretty important for the community engagement work that we're doing. That's one that I would envision asking to be allowed to keep.
In the future, okay.
Yeah. We think we need to keep 8 of our 21 race to the top positions, and are planning that ask for the 17-19 biennium.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. This team, our program team, is the one that is charged with overseeing the contracts and programs for our core early learning services. And this team is also the team that administers the race to the top grant. Most of the work of that grant falls under this group. You see a bunch of programs listed here that the program team is responsible for. We're going to talk a lot about those in the last third of my presentation. Then we have our policy and partnerships team. This team is working to implement our major strategic investments and initiatives that focus on the system versus focusing on program administration, which is what the program team is focused on. This team is led by David Mandel, who's our director of policy and research and who probably everyone on this committee has spent a fair amount of time with. This is the team that is tasked with the implementation of the early learning hubs. They're also tasked with the implementation of our early literacy grant and our kindergarten partnership and innovation grant. And then finally, we have our biggest team. This is our business operations team. And I do want to spend just a little bit of time unpacking what they do because it's our largest. So as you know, we brought over the child care division out of employment, moved it into the early learning division, made it the Office of Child Care. And that brought with us a large number of licensing and regulatory staff. So when you look at the whole division's org chart, you see a lot of people on it. And that's because we brought with us all of the folks that do licensing and regulatory work. We have 9 field offices across the state, and the staff that work out in those offices work with child care providers to license them, to bring them into compliance with state and federal rules. And then they work with them in many cases to improve their programs. We have the same mindset that
the rest of the agency has around compliance, which is that it's a customer service function, and we don't go in just to punish people with a checklist, but really to help them improve their programs. These folks carry pretty heavy caseloads. The average caseload is 108 providers per licensing specialist. Some of them have caseloads that are much higher. And as you'll learn in a bit, there is additional pressure on this unit as we figure out how to implement new federal rules that are attached to our CCDF funding that are going to require us to start to monitor license-exempt care in the same way that we monitor licensed care. So anybody who receives a child, who any child care provider, whether they're licensed or license-exempt, that receives government funding through a subsidy, our office, starting in December 2016, is going to have to start to regulate them. And so there will be additional pressure put on the caseloads of those licensing specialists. The rules were finalized in December 2014 and have to be implemented by December 2016, so our office is actively engaged in figuring out how to accomplish that work. I wish I could tell you our perfectly baked plan right now, but we just haven't had enough time between December and now to map it all out, although I think we'll have it pretty well figured out by summer.
Megan, I think if this is a good spot to transition, if we have any final questions or comments. I think we're going to let you breathe.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5016, House Bill 5017, and information for the good of the order, Mr. Wilson.
Of course, no meeting tomorrow. There is a full committee meeting, I believe. Also, they'll be back. I'm assuming you want to continue with early learning on Monday and then move through the presentation. Tuesday will be public testimony day. We will be in another room, either D or E, I believe, but I'll have to make sure, and we'll make sure you know that by Monday morning. Monday we'll be here, but Tuesday and Wednesday we'll be in a different room, a little larger room. And basic public testimony rules, if you're over 100 miles, Tuesday for sure. If you're here, you may have to delay the others until Wednesday.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Huffman, you have an important announcement.
Just a question, Madam Chair. Was that Patty enough?
No.
If it's possible for Mr. Wilson to be able, in light of my confusion this morning, and I, for the benefit of the entire committee, so that I don't continue being confused and ask those confusing questions, is it possible to get a comparison done of the governor's proposed budget and the co-chairs so that I can start getting an idea of what comes out of the $60 million pot of money, what is in other areas, line items that I may not see or know about, so that I can start getting a clearer picture of what we're, so that I know the right questions to ask, I guess, in part.
Madam Chair, Representative Hoffman, I do have a document. I'm trying to clean it up so it's a little easier to understand and probably only deal with the general fund or the state resources. Otherwise, I have a four-page document about that big that is large and can be confusing. But I do want to make sure folks understand the co-chairs. It's a framework. Mm-hmm. It lays out specific amounts for just a few items, albeit the gigantic big ones. And then does say, here's a $60 million pot in addition to all the other resources and current service level that you have that, you know, provide flexibility to the committee to take a look at and move around if under whatever rules there are around maintenance of effort and things. But they did put an undesignated $60 million pot for those new initiatives.
It would help because I need to get an idea of what comes out of grant and aid and stuff like that, because I'll be honest, I'm a little lost right now.
Okay. I will try to put that together in the next few days or finalize it and get it out to members and maybe even spend a couple minutes going through it with the subcommittee just so we start off on the same page.
Thank you.
Representative Huffman, that is, and I would like to hear Senator Monroe's comments on this. Depending upon when we decide we want to roll out the, not we, but the body decides to roll out the education budget, some of those numbers will be up to us as a committee to debate and discuss, and we got a long road yet ahead of us. And don't worry about asking questions, okay, because some of them we can't answer yet. Did you have any comments?
Oh, that's absolutely right. My understanding is that we'll put out a K-12 budget number sometime when the big co-chairs and the presiding officers agree. And that budget will probably be the $7.24 billion figure that we've seen. Then we'll have an opportunity to work other parts of the education budget, including the early learning and so
CTE
on.
And
all of it.
Yeah.
And at the end, there will be, there always is, a Christmas tree bill that, if there's additional money, allocates that additional money and adds to the other budgets that we would have already passed.
But that, yeah, there's no simple and easy process to, unless Senator Monroe
and
I wanted to do this for another 10 years maybe.
Yeah, the frustrating thing will be that at the end, when we're putting the finishing touches on the education budgets, we may be dissolved, and that may happen in the capital construction sub.
Right.
That sometimes happens. I always urge the big co-chairs to let us do our work that we're the best qualified to do, including the finishing touches, but they don't always listen to me.
Senator Roblin?
Yeah, just for a bit of levity, because this is getting fairly heavy duty here, it reminded me of my early education and watching early TV when Representative Huffman asked to talk to Mr. Wilson, and I just thought of Dennis the Menace, and I thought we could maybe...
Just call me Dennis. That's where he's going.
Thank you, Senator Roblin, and what we're trying to say is, you take each day one at a time, and let's just do the best
you
can.
We didn't spend 5.5 hours on one bill. I mean,
Senator, I am adjourning this meeting. I am adjourning this meeting.